Can we create vulnerability in the HIV virus?
The association between casino opening and childhood obesity.
Hepatitis C infection appears to be declining, but why?
And does moving children from high poverty neighborhoods affect mental disorders during adolescence?
That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed, the weekly look at the medical headlines from Johns Hopkins, posted on March 7th, 2014. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang, professor of medicine at Johns Hopkins and vice chairman of medicine at the University of Texas in San Antonio.
Rick, I'd like to start, if you don't mind, with the New England Journal of Medicine, this idea that somehow we can mess with HIV so that we can render it susceptible.
I think of the four studies we're going to talk about today, this is the one I thought was really most exciting, just in terms of its novelty. It is a remarkable story of what we call bedside to bench and back to bedside research. It started with the discovery that for the HIV virus to enter the lymphocytes, it not only binds to something called CD4, but it has another receptor called CCR5 or chemokine R5. So it binds to both of those receptors together to gain entrance into the cell. Subsequently, we've discovered that persons who are heavily exposed to HIV yet did not become infected had abnormalities in the CCR5 protein that didn't bind to the HIV virus. So this is a really unique study in which they did gene editing of the CCR5 receptor in T cells and then injected them into people that were HIV infected. They took T cells, they genetically altered them with something called zinc finger nucleases for our scientists out there, so that the receptor that was made on these T cells was defective. They infused them into individuals to determine, A, whether it was safe and how it affected the HIV infection. And what they discovered was that, first of all, they could give them safely. Furthermore, these cells lasted for an average of about a year. And in half the individuals, when they took them off HIV therapy, although they developed virus in the bloodstream again, it did not appear to affect the longevity of these cells. And in fact, one of the individuals in whom they stopped the medication, he was cured of the HIV. That is, they couldn't detect it in the serum. So this is a very novel approach for gene editing and reinfusing cells. And this may ultimately be an important step towards HIV therapy and other therapies as well.
Way cool, of course, and something that we've all been moving toward for a long time, how to effectively manipulate the genome such that we can create these kinds of changes and have them manifest in a way that's clinically beneficial.
Absolutely. And this was a proof of concept in taking a gene and altering it so that you had less of an active protein. But there are cases where we can actually insert things into the gene as well. It's a small study. It's only 12 individuals, but the concept's really important.
Clearly, then, the thing that I'm going to choose on the blog this week. Let's move from NEJM then to the Journal of the American Medical Association. A couple studies taking a look at kids. Let's look first at casino openings and childhood obesity.
Just the title alone fascinated me. We sometimes wonder whether casino opening or gambling has any positive benefits. This was an opportunity to look at American Indian tribes in the United States, some of whom already had casinos, some of whom had no casinos, and some of whom they had either an opening or expansion. And they looked to see whether this could affect childhood obesity. We know in tribes that have open casinos that it raises their income. Lower income children are more likely to be obese. So the real question is, if you have some sort of a shock therapy where you suddenly raise the income, and that's what casinos do, does it affect the incidence of childhood obesity? And what they discovered was in the 57 tribes that the slot machines, they gauged this by slots per capita, were associated with a decrease in childhood obesity. For every increase in slot per capita, it reduced the rate of obesity by about 5%. That's pretty remarkable.
That is impressive. Is this not because I suspect the kids were there like yanking on that one arm banded and getting more exercise?
That's great, Elizabeth. That wasn't one of the hypotheses put forward as to how this might occur. You might imagine on an individual basis, they could afford healthier food. That's one possibility. Second, as a community, they were involved with healthier habits. It increased the income, but not the employment rate. So it really does tie socioeconomic status to childhood obesity.
As you already said, at least one good thing with regard to casino openings. I'm not sure I would advocate for more casinos to be open because that would drive down the socioeconomic status because it would be broader and probably wouldn't have the same impact. Let's move then to the other study relative to kids, an intervention that we thought was going to make a difference, at least for some kids, but turns out that may have a deleterious impact. That's what happens when you move kids from an area that's poverty-stricken to a more affluent area.
This was a very surprising finding to me. We know that youth that are in high poverty neighborhoods have very high rates of health issues and have high rates of emotional problems as well. This is another opportunity to look at what I'm going to call a shock treatment, a sudden cataclysmic change. Kids that have been in a high poverty area and suddenly have the opportunity to move to an area that was less poverty stricken. And that happened as a result of what's called the moving to opportunity demonstration, which occurred from 1994 to 1998. Families that were in public housing and high poverty areas were randomized to move out of those areas or randomized to staying in those areas. And then they look 10 or 15 years down the road and say, how does this move affect mental disorders during adolescence? In over 4,600 public housing families that had almost 3,700 children, those that were randomized to move and actually did so, the boys had a higher incidence of developing major depression, post-traumatic stress disorder, and conduct disorders. Conversely, the girls that moved to less poverty-stricken areas were more likely to have a decrease in the rate of major depression and a decrease in the rate of conduct disorders.
Of course, we want to know, well, why is that? What are the hypotheses that surround that? The other question I would ask is, if we do that really early in life, how does that impact on these kids versus waiting until they're slightly older?
These were children that were moved between the ages of 0 and 8, and then they were followed 10 to 15 years later. So they were moved relatively early. With regard to the mechanism, we don't know the mechanism. I found it interesting that even the authors didn't propose a hypothesis.
Well, clearly the conclusion is not to move all the families with young girls out of poverty-stricken situations and leave young boys in those circumstances.
Absolutely. That's not the right thing. This indicates that large-scale disruptive social interventions may not positively affect all the people involved.
More on this later, I'm sure. Finally, let's turn to Annals of Internal Medicine. A study suggesting that the rate of hepatitis C infection is declining. However, the hypothesis I've seen on explaining this particular finding is that, oops, a lot of those baby boomers are dying off, and so therefore the number of people infected is going down.
This is a report from the National Health and Nutrition Examination Survey conducted from 2003 to 2010, looking at what the prevalence of hepatitis C infection is in the United States. So they surveyed 30,000 individuals through blood tests, and what they discovered was that the estimated prevalence of hepatitis C infection is about 1%. That corresponds to about 2.7 million people that are chronically infected with hepatitis C in the United States. And that's important because it's a treatable disease. Untreated, it leads to an increased risk of death from cirrhosis and also liver cancer. And in fact, deaths among persons with hepatitis C are higher than deaths among people with HIV infection now. The really important thing is that there's a recommendation that all individuals born between 1945 and 1965 have testing for hepatitis C. And the reason for that is when they looked at the individuals in the NHANES survey and asked, do you have one of the risk factors? Have you had a transfusion? Do you have multiple sexual partners? To use intravenous drugs. Only about 50% of the individuals with the chronic infection had one or more of the identifiable risk factors. So that means if you only target the high-risk population, you're going to miss at least half the people that have a chronic infection in the United States.
And since we're in this cohort, I guess I have to put you on the spot and say, hey, have you been screened for hep C?
As a matter of fact, I have. And as you're aware, many healthcare professionals have routine hepatitis screening. Now, most people are asymptomatic with hepatitis C infection until they develop cirrhosis, liver scarring, or until they develop liver cancer. If we do routine testing, that suggests approximately 800,000 people that are unaware of the infection would be recognized, and we could save 120,000 lives just with a simple blood test.
And as we know, Mark Sulkowski, our colleague here at Johns Hopkins, is the head of an investigation that's shown that treatment for hep C has become way less onerous. It's oral. It's going to completely avoid the use of interferon very shortly. So not only should we be screened, but we have effective treatment that really is tolerable and extremely effective.
You're right, Elizabeth. The treatment for hepatitis C is undergoing rapid changes with therapies that are more effective and have less side effects. So if any of our listeners have not been tested, again, particularly those born between 1945 and 1965, let us encourage you to do so.
Excellent. On that good news note, then, that's a look at this week's medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all live well.